From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Scott Greenberg, and this morning, author Rebecca Tuhus-Dubrow talks about her new book, Atomic Dreams, explaining why the conversation around nuclear power is changing and what it could mean for our climate future and how her own thinking has shifted along the way. Then we speak with Jeff Merrifield, a former commissioner at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, about new nuclear technologies and the future of power generation. These guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio right here on KPCW in Park City. From the Cold War to climate change, nuclear power has been one of the most divisive and misunderstood sources of energy on the planet. In her new book, Atomic Dreams, The New Nuclear Evangelists and the Fight for the Future of Energy, journalist Rebecca Tuhus-Dubrow takes us inside the surprising coalition of scientists, activists, and unlikely advocates who are reimagining nuclear's role in a clean energy future. Today on Cool Science Radio, we talk with Ms. Tuhus-Dubrow about why the narrative around nuclear power is shifting, what it can mean for our climate goals, and how one writer's own thinking transformed along the way. Rebecca, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been a lifelong environmentalist. What was your gut reaction to nuclear power before starting this book, and what made you want to dig deeper?
Well, I have to admit, I never had particularly strong feelings about nuclear. I just hadn't thought about it very much. But I think if you'd asked me when I was growing up in the 90s and in the 2000s, I would have had, just a negative gut reaction. Just, ooh, that sounds a little dirty and dangerous. Just sort of vaguely negative associations. But what happened was I had been very concerned about climate change for a long time. And in the 2010s, I started to hear more about nuclear energy. And I started to hear about it from scientists that I respected, who I knew shared my climate concerns and were saying that nuclear had to be part of the solution. So I figured that if I trusted what they were saying about climate, maybe I should also listen to what they had to say about nuclear.
So nuclear kind of has a negative connotation, whether it was from the atomic bomb or, this whole idea of meltdowns, Three Mile Island, of course, comes to mind, Fukushima. There's been this kind of whole negative connotation around nuclear. And then, as a matter of fact, Diablo Canyon was supposed to close. That's in California for our listeners. But then California changed its mind. Can you tell us a little bit why that movement was such a turning point in the nuclear debate?
Yes. So it might require a little context, but Diablo Canyon is a very controversial nuclear power plant in California, located on the Central Coast. And it was first proposed in the 60s, and despite enormous protests, it was finally completed in the mid-80s and has been running since then. In 2016, PG&E, which is the utility that runs it, reached a deal with environmental and labor groups to shutter it in the 2025. And the idea was that it would be its electricity would be fully replaced by renewable sources and efficiency. And this was seen as a template for the rest of the nation and possibly the world to transition away from both fossil fuels and nuclear power. So that was the plan as of 2016, but a small group of pro-nuclear activists emerged and began to protest the plan to shut it down. And that's a long story, and their activism was not the only reason. But eventually, in August of 2022, the governor and the state legislature reversed that decision and decided to keep the plant open for at least 5 years longer. And I think it was seen as a turning point for several reasons. Diablo Canyon had always been kind of at the center of all of this controversy about nuclear power, and it was seen as a symbol on both sides of the debate. And so the prospect of reversing this decision in a state that had been historically anti-nuclear, you know, that was run by Democrats, that was seen as having a larger meaning. So a lot of people perceived it as a victory for the pro-nuclear side that could herald larger progress for nuclear power in general.
Well, your book is fascinating, and you really bring some characters to life. And two of the most unlikely central characters in your book, Heather Hoff and Kristen Zaitz. Now, they went from actually working in the power plant to becoming activists themselves. What surprised you the most about their story?
Yeah, they were really interesting because they, kind of like me, were kind of hippie-ish. They were very outdoorsy. They were just these hardcore environmentalists and had both ended up working at the nuclear plant kind of by accident. They were both very skeptical about nuclear. But through their experience working at the plant, they learned more and became, you know, more comfortable with it, less worried about the risks, and also convinced that it had a really important role to play in fighting climate change. So I think that in itself was initially surprising. They founded a group called Mothers for Nuclear, which sounds very counterintuitive if you know anything about the history of nuclear power and the anti-nuclear movement. So it was surprising that two women who had that kind of hippie-ish tree-hugger background would end up being very strong pro-nuclear advocates. I think another thing that really surprised me as I started to get to know them was I initially expected that they would be somewhat reluctant supporters of nuclear, maybe even a little apologetic, like, you know, oh, it's unfortunate, but the crisis is so bad that we need to consider nuclear as part of the solution. But it turned out they weren't like that at all. They were really, really enthusiastic nuclear supporters who basically thought the biggest problem with nuclear was public opinion, and that, you know, the public just had all these misconceptions about nuclear, and that was really what was holding it back, and that nuclear power itself was almost a panacea that, you know, could solve a lot of problems. And so that was a perspective that I hadn't expected to encounter, just especially from people with their background.
I have to say, reading the book, their perspective was absolutely counterintuitive. And, you know, the Mothers for Nuclear does actually kind of sound hippie-ish in and of itself, with kind of a great title for their activism. So, yeah, you really bring those characters to life. I really love them. I love the whole idea of Mothers for Nuclear being sort of a hippie term of art. But I'm curious, how does our mindset in the country, where we kind of think of nuclear either as, you know, oh my gosh, that's terrible, we don't know how to control it, or, you know, hey, listen, this could maybe be the panacea we're looking for with respect to providing power and clean energy, for lack of a better word. But I'm just kind of curious how that mindset shapes how we in the United States see both nuclear energy and climate solutions going hand in hand, or do they?
Well, some people certainly argue that they do. I think it's very complex, and I think there are so many factors at play. There are generational differences. I think for an older generation that had just stronger associations with the atomic bomb and those fears, and maybe remember Chernobyl, for some of those members of that generation, it can be very hard to think about nuclear power in any other way. But then for a younger generation, and I don't want to oversimplify because people of all different ages have all different opinions, but for some of the younger advocates I met, they just those associations aren't as strong for them, and their focus is on climate change. And they just grew up hearing that nuclear could be part of a solution to climate change and should be. So I think public opinion is in flux. I think there has been some movement. There was a recent poll showing that it was at, you know, support for nuclear power was at near record levels. But I think, you know, there are factors like the risk. If something were to happen, that can always change public opinion again. There's the expense. The only recent projects that have been completed in the U.S. were billions of dollars over budget, and in years, past the deadline they had been expected to be finished by. So there are some real concerns there. But what I found in my reporting was that nuclear power does offer very serious advantages in terms of being able to supply large amounts of steady electricity on a small land footprint. And it also has very serious challenges, but that it, you know, it's hard to just totally dismiss it as an option in our energy future.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Rebecca Tuhus-Dubrow, who is the author of the book Atomic Dreams, The New Nuclear Evangelists and the Fight for the Future of Energy. And we're talking about activism, and you were talking about some of the younger activists. I'm curious, if a young climate activist told you they were kind of on the fence about nuclear power, what would you say to them today after having written this book and done all the research and talking to activists actually on both sides? I'm curious, if they're on the fence, what do you now turn around and what's the message you'd want to tell them?
Well, I guess I should say first that what I feel like I can contribute is I'm not necessarily trying to advance any particular view on nuclear power, but I thought that I could try to fairly and accurately represent a range of views, although I focus more on the pro-nuclear side, and I wanted to tell a good story. So it's more narrative than polemical. And I also, as I said a moment ago, I did come to think that it was a solution that should be on the table, should be considered as part of our energy portfolio. So I guess I would tell a young activist that. One thing I learned through the course of reporting and writing the book is just to have some humility about any of my opinions on energy choices and on climate change. And just that, because for one thing, it was humbling to realize that if I had been, a parent back in the 70s or 80s, I'm almost 100% sure that I would have been an anti-nuclear activist at the time, because that just seemed to make a lot of sense at the time. And so it's just to realize that, you know, circumstances change, science changes, and it continues to change. So I tend to hold my views kind of lightly and be open to both changing my mind and just open to new options, new alternatives and possibilities as they emerge. So I think we just have to keep, you know, not get too attached to any one solution or any one source of energy, but just continue to be open as circumstances evolve.
I've been reading a lot lately about micronuclear. I'm not sure I completely understand what it is, other than it sounds like a very interesting, new, and exciting form of energy that we might want to look at in the future. Which of the advanced nuclear technologies out there right now excite you the most, or at least give you the most pause, maybe, about how we use it or move forward with it?
So there's a company called Oklo, and they are designing small modular reactors. I know at one point they were working on micro reactors, and I think they expanded the size that they're planning. But their technology, that's the one I kind of learned the most about, and it sounded extremely impressive. They are planning to recycle, reprocess and recycle spent fuel. So to actually turn nuclear waste into the fuel for their reactor. The reactor they're designing will have what's called passive safety features. So it should be incapable of meltdowns of the kind we've seen in the past. And it's a smaller size, as I mentioned. So that the idea is that it improves the economics, the upfront costs. And so I visited their offices and met with this couple, Jake DeWitt and Carolyn Cochran, who founded the company. And I was really impressed by them and by this technology. At the same time, I know there are some concerns, for example, about reprocessing nuclear waste into new fuel. That sounds like a win-win, but there are proliferation concerns about it, and just Oklo and the sector in general of small modular reactors, it's taken a long time, and we could debate what the factors might be that have held it back, but you know, it has taken a long time, and there have been setbacks, and it's just not totally proven yet, so we'll just have to wait and see how that all plays out.
So it feels like with at least modular or micronuclear, it's a double-edged sword, right? You know, you've got the science side of this that maybe is still evolving, the technology is still evolving. But I'm curious, are there any significant policy obstacles right now that might be standing in the way of advancement of using more nuclear?
Mm-hmm. So in the pro-nuclear community, there is a strong belief that regulations have held back the development of new nuclear, and that they've been too burdensome and inappropriate. There was a bipartisan law that passed in 2024, the ADVANCE Act, that instructed the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to implement some reforms so that they could be more nimble and just develop more appropriate regulations for these new designs. Those reforms at the NRC were underway, and then the Trump administration has kind of caused a lot of disruption. They agree that regulations have been too burdensome, but they've taken some very controversial steps to kind of intervene in the NRC and compromise its independence. So it's unclear where exactly that's headed, but there are concerns that could compromise safety. And so I think it's always a really tough call when you're talking about regulation. You know, where does appropriate regulation end and you know, overly cumbersome regulation begin? It's a really fine line, and it's basically impossible to say exactly where that line is. But I think, you know, there is a case that reforms were warranted at the NRC, and that they could be helpful. Trump's more recent actions are, I think, raising more concerns.
Well, the book Atomic Dreams, it's absolutely fascinating. You take a very complicated and somewhat controversial topic, nuclear energy, and bring it to light in a really entertaining and fascinating way. I just love the way you bring characters to life. And everybody out there, if you're at all interested in nuclear energy, I highly recommend this book. I absolutely love it. And it actually makes me feel more hopeful about the future of atomic energy, nuclear energy, whatever we want to call it. I'm curious, was there a story or a fact that maybe didn't make it into the book that still sticks with you today?
That's a great question. I've been trying to pursue a few threads that I felt like I didn't get to fully pursue in the book. One is, I did mention this in the book, but fairly briefly. There was a kind of amazing program that is far more obscure than it should be, called Megatons to Megawatts. And it came about in the wake of the Cold War. And essentially, Russia had all of these, had tens of thousands of nuclear weapons kind of scattered around the former Soviet Union. There were a lot of concerns that this could pose a lot of safety risks and that these could end up in the wrong hands. There was a program that was intended to address that proliferation risk, but also had the benefit of providing fuel for American nuclear plants. So essentially Russia, which was desperately in need of cash at the time, agreed to dismantle these weapons and downblend the highly enriched uranium, so dilute it so that it turned into low enriched uranium, which could be used in American power plants. So they shipped this low enriched uranium to the US, and for about 20 years, it actually supplied about 10% of all US electricity. So, you know, one in 10 light bulbs in the US were lit by this uranium that came from dismantled Soviet weapons. So I think that's an incredible story, and that we can learn from that. And I hope it's a model that we can resurrect at some point, because it's, you know, turning swords into plowshares, right? That's the phrase, on this massive scale, massive high-tech scale. And I did mention that in the book, but what I didn't really get into was I had been able to interview the man who came up with this idea and made it happen. His name is Thomas Neff, and he was a physicist who was affiliated with MIT. And he was very concerned about all of these loose weapons in the former Soviet Union. And he kind of hatched this crazy idea and then published an op-ed in the New York Times about it. And then worked very hard traveling to the region, to Russia and that region, dozens of times to make this a reality. And he died about a year ago. So I've been thinking of trying to write something about him, but because he, you know, he's kind of an unsung hero. And so I think his story should be better known.
From bombs to bulbs. What a great idea. What a great concept. I hope you do write it. I would love to follow up on that. That'd be lovely. Well, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure. And I can, again, the book is Atomic Dreams. Fantastic. I have one final question, I guess. After writing this book, do you personally feel more hopeful or more concerned about humanity's ability to decarbonize for the sake of the planet?
Well, I was feeling more hopeful, but, you know, when I was wrapping up the book in 2024, I think, but since President Trump has taken office, he's really gone in a drastically different direction and has no interest in decarbonization. So that's clearly a huge obstacle, and that has made me more pessimistic, I'm sorry to say. But in terms of nuclear, the Trump administration, they've taken a variety of steps, and some are expected to boost nuclear power, and that's their stated intention. But others may end up hurting the industry. It's too soon to tell. But that is actually kind of the one low carbon energy source that they do support. So the future of nuclear could be bright. There's definitely a ton of interest in it. I personally, you know, some of the characters in my book are basically think nuclear should supply almost all of our energy needs. I tend to support a more diverse portfolio of different kinds of low carbon energy. Solar, wind, I think should be important parts of our energy system. So they've now with Trump's policies, there's you know, they've had huge setbacks and there's a lot of uncertainty about their future in the US. So I'm really concerned about that. But you know, I do think nuclear power can have a role to play. And so I'll be watching to see what happens there.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Rebecca, for joining us today on Cool Science Radio. It's been enlightening.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg, and today we talk with the Honorable Jeffrey S. Merrifield, a former presidential appointee to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, about the current state of affairs of nuclear energy in the United States. Jeff has spent over three decades of involvement in the energy industry and has developed wide-ranging relationships throughout the international nuclear community. He is considered a leader in advanced nuclear and fusion deployment and has consulted with large and developing nuclear utilities, suppliers, and governments on the deployment of complex energy systems. Jeff is currently an attorney with the Pillsbury Law Firm in Washington, D.C., and heads up the firm's nuclear energy team and co-leader of the firm's energy transition practice. He is widely recognized as an international thought leader on nuclear power and the deployment of complex energy systems for the avoidance of carbon generation. Jeff, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Doug, thank you very much for having me.
So, first question, right? Nuclear energy is a divisive topic. It conjures up images of weapons and meltdowns, while at the same time has taken on the role of a non-carbon source of clean energy. Do you have any sense of where we as Americans stand on that debate today in our lexicon or our culture?
Well, Scott, I think things have evolved in that regard. I mean, many people who are older generations, and I still consider myself on the cusp of that, you know, have a lot of memories of what happened with Three Mile Island and Chernobyl back in the 70s and 80s. But a lot of younger folks, and by that I say people who are under the age of 45, really think about nuclear in a different way. If you look at currently how nuclear energy is operating in the United States, we have 92 operating nuclear power plants that generate about 20% of the power we have in the country, and it's just about 50% of the total carbon-free generation that we have. They've operated at a 95% capacity factor, which is the highest of any energy source, and they've been really reliable and safe. And so people who are under 45 who are concerned about climate change, they're concerned about the environment, you know, they look at that as a source of energy that is able to operate in a non-polluting and safe way. And so you think about it differently than I think a lot of folks who are you're my age. And so I think the country has changed in that regard. One indicator I would use for that is sort of where things come from in Congress. I started working in the United States Senate back in 1987, right after Chernobyl. And there were a majority of members of Congress who simply weren't supportive of nuclear. Today, that is entirely different. There was a bill that went through Congress about a year ago called the ADVANCE Act. It made a variety of changes to incentivize building nuclear power plants. And it passed the U.S. Senate by a vote of 88-2. Ed Markey and Bernie Sanders, two, you know, notable anti-nuclear senators, voted against it, but everyone else was for it. And President Biden signed it into law, and it's really helped jumpstart, I think, a lot of efforts to get these deployed. So a lot of things really changed, and really, I think nuclear's got a tailwind right now.
A lot of things have changed, including the new nuclear technologies. I'm curious, where do you think we stand today in their development? Are we moving forward with newer, safer types of nuclear energy?
We are, and you know, that's one of the things I have the benefit of. I work with a huge number of developers, both with fission, traditional nuclear technologies, and fusion. And the amount of innovation and investment in this arena is really quite extraordinary. You know, I came back into it about 10 years ago from doing some other work in constructing nuclear power plants. And in that 10 years, the change has been rapid and really noteworthy. But for your listeners, I'd sort of break it down this way. 20 years ago, when I was an NRC commissioner, And frankly, all of the nuclear power plants that we have in the United States are what are called light water reactors. They use tap water to both moderate them and heat them. And all of them are generally in a range of about 1,000 megawatts. That's large enough to power about 1 million homes. And so when we were building those in that time frame, the utilities that operate them, you know, were all buying sort of a single set of reactors, 1,000 megawatt reactors, light water. And they were made by either General Electric, Westinghouse, or Framatome, which is a French company. Today, it's quite different. There are actually what I would call four product lines. So we're going to see a series of those large light water reactors built. And I would postulate anywhere between a half dozen and a dozen will get ordered and built in the course of the next probably five to eight years. The second category is what are called small modular reactors. So these two are light water reactors, but they're smaller, typically about 300 megawatts. There are several companies that are building those. GE has a design, Westinghouse, a company called Holtec, which is out of New Jersey. And in the UK, Rolls-Royce, another one in the upper Northwest called NuScale. And these are all reactors in that general range. Ontario Power Generation, which is Canada's largest utility, has ordered several of those from GE, and they've already begun construction. TVA, which is based in Tennessee and is a nuclear utility, has also indicated they're going to order several of those GE reactors as well. So progress there is underway as we speak. The third category are what I would call advanced reactors. Sometimes in the nuclear community, we call them Generation 4. And these are non-light water reactors. So they use things like high-temperature gas, typically helium, to use as a coolant or to circulate the heat in the reactor. Molten salt is one that you're going to hear a lot more about. And then liquid metal, either sodium or lead. And these reactors do have higher safety factors. They're all designs that came out of U.S. National Laboratories under the Atomic Energy Commission and DOE during the 1960s and 70s, but they're now at a point of being commercialized. And so several of these you're going to hear about have received significant government funding. TerraPower, which is building a reactor in Kemmerer, Wyoming. That's a Bill Gates company. There's a company based out of Rockville, Maryland called X Energy, founded by a guy named Cam Gafarian, who was a NASA contractor for many years. They have a deal with Dow to build several of those in Texas for Dow Corporation. And then they also have a deal that they've announced with Amazon up in Washington State. So we're going to see a series of those reactors. And what is different is they generate very high heat load. And so that is very helpful for industrial applications where you don't need just the power. You also want to use that very high heat for other industrial processes. Finally, there's the microreactors. These are typically under 25 megawatts. They're really sort of two flavors of those. The military has several designs that they've selected, including X Energy has one, BWXT, which is the company that brings us our naval reactors for all of our submarines and carriers. They're going to have deployable reactors that can be put on a plane and taken halfway around the world and set up and operate within 72 hours, we're going to see those producing power for the U.S. Army probably within the next 12 to 24 months. And then finally, there are a series of other microreactor developers that will be deployed for remote sites, oil and gas drilling, mining, companies like Radiant, Allo, Oklo, Last Energy, among others. So you're going to hear a lot more about those. A lot of interest from Silicon Valley. I would say we can talk about this more if you want, but I think the data center and AI arena has really helped move some of this forward as well.
I actually do want to talk about this more. I am fascinated by this. You talked about I think you called it small modular reactor. I think we call them SMRs. Yes. I heard that term. And we're also talking about these other nuclear reactors. I think you just said there was something portable where the Army can just pick them up and almost like a generator.
That's exactly the vision. This actually dates back to the first Trump administration when General Mattis was the Secretary of Defense. And if you go back to that time frame, what the military was saying was, when you look at the wars that we were engaged in both Iraq and Afghanistan, about half of the U.S. casualties were associated with the transport or accompanying the transport of liquids, either fuel or other materials for forward deployed troops. And so what the military is really looking at is how do you decarbonize some of your forward base locations, because they use a lot of power. There are possibilities of electrifying some of our fighting forces. How do you do that in a way to get that energy in a denser manner that's portable? And that's where they're going with these portable reactors. And so the thinking is you'd have something that could basically fit in several cargo boxes, be able to fly halfway around the world, and be set up and operating within 72 hours. What wasn't said at the time, but I think has become much more obvious, is the nature of war fighting is changing with Ukraine, the sheer amount of drones, the possibility of hypersonic weapons. I think what we're seeing is the potential to deploy laser-based systems in a forward-deployed area. The U.S. Navy, for example, has two destroyers in the Pacific, which have 120 kilowatt-sized laser systems that can be used for shooting down drones and incoming missiles. To really deal with hypersonic weapons, you've got to be able to do laser shots that are about a megawatt. And the only way you're going to be able to do that is with nuclear-powered systems. It would otherwise use massive amounts of petroleum-based fuels to try to do that, and that's completely contrary to what they're trying to accomplish. So as we move toward a warfighting force that uses a lot more lasers, nuclear, I think, is going to be a key component of that.
Wow. Okay, so this is really flipping it on its head, and it's maybe a rabbit hole I wasn't intending to go down, but now we're there. So in the old days, when we said nuclear and warfare, of course, we were talking about something completely different, right? We were talking about maybe nuclear warheads. Now we're talking about nuclear being deployed in warfare as an energy source, not as a destructive force, which is fascinating to me that this is kind of turned around 180 degrees.
Well, you know, keep in mind, this isn't anything new, because people forget all of the U.S. submarines and all of the U.S. aircraft carriers are nuclear powered. And so the U.S. Navy operates about 100 nuclear reactors and has done so, you know, safely and effectively for, gosh, we've been doing that since the mid-1950s. So you're really looking at, you know, going on 70 years of safe operations in the U.S. Navy. So this is not, it's not really a big stretch. I think what has enabled some of this is frankly, the ability of us to have laser systems that can achieve those higher densities. And frankly, you know, some of that technology is coming out of Israel with the Golden Dome. Some of it's coming out of the U.S. So I think we're going to see a real transformation on that capability, but it's really not new. One factoid, a little trivia question. A lot of folks don't realize the first really mobile reactor that got deployed was by the U.S. Army at the McMurdo Sound base in Antarctica. They operated a nuclear reactor there for about 25 years to power that very important research facility. So actually, a lot of this stuff isn't new. It's just a new application.
All right. But, you know, when we think about nuclear power, at least when I think about nuclear power, I think about it lighting up a grid of a city. You were mentioning earlier on an interview about how we could potentially power, I think you said, 1 million homes. But now we're talking about doing things in the industrial and obviously in the military. But let's talk about the industrial for a second. If I'm not mistaken, and I'm not picking on Amazon or on SpaceX, but I know that these AI farms take up a tremendous amount of power, a lot of them being powered now by gas turbines. Are we shifting our thinking towards decarbonization by using nuclear now in the industries, in these vast power-consuming industries? Is this something on our future?
That's exactly the case. I would point out, you know, Amazon has four people in their management structure who have the word nuclear in their title. So I think that gives you some indication of the seriousness with which these companies are really thinking about the deployment of nuclear. You know, the current administration is not as, I think, focused on carbon control as the prior administration. But I would say these large companies, and we mentioned, you know, Amazon, Google, Meta, ChatGPT, you know, all these folks are deploying, you know, very large data centers to power these AI systems. They use, typically AI system uses about 10 times as much power as a typical data center. And they want to do so in a way that, that does not generate additional carbon. They've evaluated wind, solar, and batteries, and due to the power reliability needs of those data centers, you just can't get there. Now, in the, you know, in the old days, that being 5 years ago, if you had a data center, typically it would be, you know, somewhere in the range of 30 to 40 megawatts. That was a typical data center. And a single megawatt, if you think about it in this way, a single megawatt is sufficient for about a 1,000 homes. These data centers typically were plugged into the grid, and the grid could deal with that level of power on and off. I had an opportunity to visit a data center, frankly, was in the Salt Lake City area last February. And this data center, it's a very large one, very impressive. And they got about half their power off the grid, and they got half of the power they got from gas-fired reciprocating engines. And, you know, they are looking toward building out and needing more power. And they, the question I got was, you know, who should I buy? You know, can I buy a nuclear power plant today? And those are the kind of questions that are being asked. But I think that what's driving it is simply the sheer size. These future, you know, giga centers are going to be needing thousands of megawatts. And there's some real technical challenges that go along with a data center and that uses AI. Typical data center operates at a fairly stable electric generation level. You would need power to power the data systems themselves. You also need a fair amount of power to cool it. They generate lots and lots of heat. And in Salt Lake City, that's great during the winter months. You don't really have an issue. In the middle of the summer, when the heat outside is in the 90s or near 100, a lot of air conditioning is needed to keep those chips cool and operating effectively. That's going to require a lot of power, and it's going to require power that can be reliable, and that's why they're looking at nuclear to power those systems.
I am excited about this. I think it's a bright future, no pun intended, with nuclear playing a lot of different roles, whether it's on the grid with our military or even our industrial complex. But I think the one huge issue that a lot of people think of is nuclear waste. What do we do about the waste, or is there waste? And what are, if any, recent developments in our administration and how we deal with that?
Yeah, let me talk about that in sort of several different ways. First, I'd like to, you know, this is typically a question I get whenever I'm in a public audience, and I'd like to demystify it a little bit. Use nuclear fuel, the fuel that is used in nuclear reactors, is the most heavily regulated metal in the world. No one on the planet has ever been killed or injured as a result of the storage of used nuclear fuel. It is actually quite compact. And if you took all the nuclear fuel from a nuclear reactor that operates 60 years, you know, you could store it all in an area less than the size of a football field. And the fact is that right now, in a typical nuclear power plant, it's used in the reactor for roughly about 6 years. It comes out, it goes into a spent fuel pool where it's cooled with water. And typically it could spend, you know, 6 or 7 years there. And then you could put it in a metal and concrete cask and put it on a concrete pad outdoors. And you could walk up to that concrete cask and not be at all injured by that material. It is something we know how to manage very, very well. What I think, you know, one of the bugaboos is I think folks in the anti-nuclear community have for a long time, quite effectively, raised that as an issue to try to scare people. And you and I both watched The Simpsons when it first came out. And, you know, they made a lot of fun of nuclear operators and, you know, glowing nuclear fuel. And it's just not an accurate reflection of what the reality is. People in the nuclear industry are very highly trained. They're not a bunch of bumpkins. And it doesn't glow. It's a dense heavy metal that just is something we can manage well. Now, having said all that, you know, we don't have Yucca Mountain in Nevada because that got killed off by the by President Obama. And so we still have to do something with it. And I think what we're seeing today is a reemergence of a view that we really ought to recycle it. 90% of the energy remains in that fuel after it's been used in a nuclear reactor. There are a variety of countries around the world, that, including France and Japan and others, who recycle that material. We have the capability of doing it here in the U.S. Frankly, we invented it. And I'm working with a series of companies right now that are getting back into that business. They want to do it differently. And there are a variety of incentives that the Trump administration is putting in place to try to jumpstart that effort. So I think we're going to hear a lot more about it in the coming years. And I think it's actually a good thing.
I am hopeful that we can do that and that we can recycle these materials. And what would we use these recycled materials for? Would they actually go right back into a nuclear reactor?
Well, that's actually the exciting thing about it. And Scott, I know your wife is very involved in medical therapies. There's sort of a couple of things. The vast bulk of the material is uranium, which could be reutilized to make new fuel. There is some amount of plutonium that is generated as a result of these actions. That material could potentially be used as a fuel source in things like molten salt reactors in a mix. Some of the other radioactive materials in that mix of the used nuclear fuel can be used in those types of reactors as well. But I think one thing that has really changed, which is quite exciting, and this gets me back to the medical part, there are some very rare isotopes included in that uranium fuel, which we're now finding could have very beneficial aspects for radiation-based therapies. So some of the targeted alpha therapies, those use very specific radionuclides. And so some of the companies that are getting into this business, Bill Gates is looking into this, others are as well, is really driven not necessarily so much by generating more uranium for the nuclear fleet, but the dollar driver is really getting access to some of these isotopes that could be used for medical therapies, some of which would be very, very valuable and are in huge demand. We don't have the supply. This might be a way of making it happen.
Wow. Okay. That is very exciting. So we have talked about a wide range of uses for nuclear just in this very short time. And there's one more question I have before we wrap this up, and that is the use of nuclear in space. I had dinner the other night with someone, has to remain anonymous, obviously, but has now been talking about actually putting a nuclear reactor on the moon, which I was jaw-dropped on the table. What do we know about that future, and why would we do that?
Well, let's start with the end part of that. Why would we do that? We do that because those systems, if we are to have permanent manned missions on the moon, the ability to provide, you know, safe, comfortable living facilities, the ability to provide the lighting, to run the machinery, to run, frankly, to be able to grow, you know, vegetables and food and all that is all going to be directly dependent on the ability to generate electricity. And so nuclear energy and different power sources, you know, have the highest energy density of any energy source that is available to us. And so we technologically have the capability of putting it on the moon. I mean, that is well within our technical capacity. The systems themselves, you could have a very small, you know, reactor or radiation-based system that could generate either heat, electricity, or both. And we have a capacity now to get it to the moon. Obviously, there's some work to be done. It's not going to be cheap, but it certainly, I think, opens up the potential for us to realistically enable the ability to have permanent manned colonies on the moon and potentially Mars.
All right. That is exciting. And how close are we to this type of future?
Well, I think ultimately what it really is going to depend on is the ability to get that material out of the atmosphere in large measure. You know, SpaceX, our friend Elon Musk, has been spending a lot of time with his Starship. If they can get that to work without blowing up over the Atlantic, if they can actually get those to be a reliable platform, which I think technically they're capable of doing, then you've got the ability to really ship larger amounts of material out of the atmosphere toward Mars and the moon. And I think that's going to be the big enabler. The reactor technologies are things that we really had within our grasp for some period, but it's the rocket ships that are really the key. And oh, by the way, some of those rocket ships in the future may be powered by either fission or fusion-based systems. One of the challenges of getting to Mars is simply the sheer amount of fuel you need to do so. If you want to get there faster, a nuclear-powered rocket engine in space is the way to do it.
Wow. We have been speaking with Jeff Merrifield, former commissioner of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, currently with the law firm of Pillsbury in Washington, D.C., and is a thought leader in the nuclear energy field. Jeff, thank you so very much for spending time with us today on Cool Science Radio. It has really been a pleasure and, quite frankly, very eye-opening conversation.
Well, thanks for having me, Scott, and perhaps sometime down the road we can have a second conversation about fusion.
I would love that. Let's get that on the calendar.
And thanks to those guests today. Jeff Merrifield was our guest in the second half. He's a former commissioner at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And then in the first half, Rebecca Tahoos-Dubrow, who talked about her book, Atomic Dreams. Now, my wonderful co-host, Scott Greenberg, took care of those interviews while I was on vacation. So it was interesting for me to listen in. Just wanted to mention, you know, nuclear, while I believe it's becoming less controversial of a topic, it's still pretty controversial. Whenever we do an interview on this topic, we always get comments. And so just a good time to point out that here at Cool Science Radio, we are here to hopefully turn you on to science, make you more curious about doing your own research into these things. And none of what we talk about expresses or is an expression of our own beliefs or opinions. It is us trying to figure out this interesting, curious world of science and technology. So thanks for taking care of that, Scott, while I was away. It was really great. Thanks also to our listeners for tuning in. You've been listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.